All right. Well, I'm just going to pray for us, pray for our time together, and then we'll go ahead and get started. God, thank you for this week at camp. Thank you for just the work that you are doing and the ways that you make things new. God, thank you even just for the rain, as unexpected as sometimes that is. Just thank you for the ways that you know how to take care of us and you know how to take care of our world. And we just pray that our eyes would be on you as we talk about young adults and their love for you and their place in this world. And I just pray that our time together would be honoring to you. And it's in your name we pray. Amen. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and my family because I'll probably talk quite a bit about my family and using them as some examples. But I am the second of four kids. My parents didn't know the Lord when they got married, but a couple years into their marriage, they both came to know the Lord through separate discipleship to different people, but within about a week of each other. And so these two separate individuals led both my parents to the Lord within a week of each other. So I've only ever known my parents as Christians, as believers. We came to family camp every summer since I was 3 years old. They'll be here for week four. And I'm the second of four. So my older sister, she is a mom of three kids, my brother-in-law, Jim. Then there's me, my younger brother, Jared, and then my youngest sister, Lex, who is also a summer staffer at Redwood. All of us are about 3 years apart. My brother and I are the longest gap. We're close to 4 years apart. And so my parents did a really good job of recognizing that between all of my siblings and I, we were all very, very different. And so they parented us with consistency, but recognizing that we were different. We had different learning styles, recognizing we had different interests. I really appreciate that about my parents. I learned a lot from them. A number of years ago, my mom told me, she said, out of all the ages that you guys have had and all the seasons of the energetic kids to the rebellious teenagers to the college students, she said, when all of you guys have been in your 20s, that's been the hardest for me as a parent. And there was a season where because we're all about 3 years apart, my older sister was just on the cusp of being 30. I was 27, my brother was 24, and my younger sister was 21. So they just had four 20-year-olds trying to figure out life all at the same time, but in different stages of it. And so my mom said, she said, there have been, you know, lots of sleepless nights for when we were teenagers, lots of hard things that they as parents went through with us as kids that were growing. But they said that them as parents, it was the hardest in our 20s because of just the burden they felt for us as growing to be adults. And so for myself, I am not a parent. I don't know what it's like to be a parent, but I have learned some things from my parents that I hope to one day put into practice myself. So for our time together this morning, I wish I had a parent perspective to offer many of you, but I don't have that perspective. But I do have the perspective of being a young adult, even just recently, and have the perspective of what young adults, what many of them are like, because I work with them throughout the years. So I can speak from that perspective. My hope is at the end of this 1 hour that we have together, I don't think I'm going to say anything that's going to be very profound for you or have any nuggets of truth, other than I hope it'll lead to conversations for if you're a parent with a young adult, a conversation for you to have with them, or if you're a current young adult, a conversation for you to have with your parents. So that's my hope. I'm just going to give a lot of information, hopefully some insight. Would love for this to be a discussion, so feel free to ask questions as we go. And that's my hope, that at the end there would be further conversations with the young adults in your life, or for young adults with the parents and mentors in your life as well. So our current young adults, there are many who are in the millennial generation, and there are many who are in the older end of the Gen Z generation. And so as we've had boomers lead to Gen Xers, lead to Gen Y, but more affectionately referred to as the millennials, now to the Gen Z. The millennials are within the age range, anyone who was born between 1980 to 1994. So the current age range of them is anyone who's 25 to 39. That's what the millennial generation would be. And so some distinctions for them, some of the big shaping events for that generation, the older young adults, is the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, the technological explosion of the internet and social media and 9/11. What's fascinating is that this next election that we'll have, it'll be the first time that there'll be a new group of voters who were not alive during 9/11. And recognizing that that's their political perspective is different than the previous generation because we lived through or have a conscious memory of living through 9/11 that day and the events that led after it. So for Gen Z, they may have been born during 9/11, but they were younger kids, so they don't necessarily have a memory of it. And so for millennials, they are entering the workforce with a very high amount of student debt. This is delaying major purchases of big purchases like weddings and homes. There is a lot of financial instability, and they are wanting to have ownership of it, but don't necessarily know how. They want partners to help them guide through the big purchases of their life. So that's a little bit of a peek inside the world of millennials right now, as they are between 25 to 39. Many of them having the expectation of what their parents had when they were their age, but it's a very different world than that. For Gen Z, it's the ages, or the years that were born between 95 to 2015. So that age range currently is anyone who's 4 to 24, big age range, a lot of development in that. Other nicknames for this generation is the I generation because of the internet and social media, as well as the post-millennials. This crazy statistic, the average Gen Zer received their first phone at the age of 10. And so the influence of social media is huge when it comes to Gen Z. Many of them grew up playing with their parents' phones or their own. They live in a very hyper-connected world because everything is accessible right in their hands. On average, they spend about 3 hours a day on their mobile device. I think that's actually a pretty low number. It's probably quite a bit more when you take into account video games, computers, and not just on their mobile phones. The Gen Zers actually have a little bit more of financial awareness because they've seen either their older siblings or older, the millennial generation, and the influence of having financial debt. And so they actually say that Gen Z, the younger generation right now, are actually being a little bit more fiscally responsible because they don't want to lean into the financial debt that they see others in. Some shaping events for the current generation, smartphones, social media, they've never known a country not at war. So war is prevalent in our news for them. And they've seen the financial struggles of their parents, who are the Gen Xers. All right, so in this world that we live in with the Gen Z students as well as the millennials, what's interesting is that in working with junior high and high school students and with young adults, most of them all fit within Gen Z, but myself, I'm a millennial, and it's been really interesting to see the rise over the years in anxiety and depression. The current world that we live in is just awful for students. I think it's always been a broken world, obviously, but some of the things that the students who come to camp that I work with or the students that I work with at a youth group down the street, they live in a world that is just prevalent with bullying, with suicide, everyone is on medication of some kind, and anxiety and depression. I've noticed it even just in the last few years of the students who come to Ponderosa, and I see the campers and some of the concerns that their parents have for them when they come for a week, and even just the amount of medications that we distribute for a week, even that has been on the rise to treat students for some of the things that they're facing. So in looking at the world in which we kind of sit in for millennials and for Gen Z, I'm going to look a little bit more towards like the older age range of Gen Z, because that would be like the early 20-year-olds, and then the younger version of the millennials, since there's kind of that gap in between where there's a lot of fluidity and some overlap between the two generations. When I do the summer staff training for our youth staff at Conference Center as well as for the Ponderosa staff, we go through a lot of adolescent development. And so looking at how, what is the developmental stages of a junior high to a high school to a young adult. And so we focus primarily on the developmental stage of the junior high and high schoolers, but what's really fascinating is to look at how that progression then leads to the young adulthood. Anytime I ask them, do you feel like you're an adult right now? And it's a room of 55 young adults, and I'll ask them, do you feel like an adult? And a few will raise their hand. Most of them will do this. And I'm like, what does this mean? I'm like, kind of an adult, kind of not. And I'll ask them, what is it that makes you an adult or not yet an adult? And it's always the, I'm not an adult because I'm not financially responsible. Or I'm still, my parents are still paying my phone bill. Or my parents are still paying for college. I'm not an adult because I don't own a home. And so I'll ask them sometimes, well, what makes an adult? And most of the time they don't have, they all have different ideas. It's when you get married, it's when you own a home, it's when you're debt-free, it's when you're making your own decisions. One just gave me a response a couple days ago saying, it's when you're able to process through the mysteries of life, the mysteries of romance, and the mysteries of grief. And I thought, oh, I haven't heard that one yet. I said, but I want to sit and kind of explore that more. It was a really interesting take on it. But oftentimes it's these external factors that they think, I'm going to be an adult when I have this. And so for some of those, I told them, I was like, based on your definitions, I'm not an adult. I don't own a home. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I am financially responsible for myself. But we all have really different definitions of this. For adolescents, you know, the season before young adulthood, it starts with puberty, but it often ends in culture. And that's not necessarily a good thing that it ends in culture, but for today it does. And so our bodies kickstart into, you're in the process of becoming an adult. That's the whole point of what adolescence, the term is. It's Latin for adolescere, which means to grow to maturity. And so the process of adolescence is to take from being a kid, and at some point your body kickstarts into puberty, and then you're in the process of growing to adulthood. And it's that process in between that we've called adolescence. And so it starts with puberty, but then it ends with culture. And that's the piece that we, as a culture, haven't done a good job of defining. When does young adulthood end and real adulthood start? And if we're letting culture be the defining factor of it, that's not necessarily the best thing, because we all have then different definitions of it. The process of adolescence has also lengthened in America in the last 100 years. And so pre-1900, adolescence started at the age of 14. That's when puberty began. In the 1970s, that age was 13. In 2012, it was 11.7. And I think that age is getting much younger. Students are entering puberty at a much younger age now than they used to. Students at Redwood or at day camp, they're entering puberty, or they're becoming sexually active at a much younger age as well. During that time too, then adulthood, it was said that pre-1900, adulthood started at age 16. So at age 16, you were considered an adult pre-1900. In 1970, it was age 18, probably because of the wars that were going on and being enlisted and drafted. You were considered 18, you're an adult. In 2012, it was mid-20s. I didn't even define what mid-20s is. It just said mid-20s. At some point, you become an adult. So the length of adolescence 100 years ago was a year and a half. In the 1970s, it was 5 years. And 7 years ago, it was 15 years. And so the process of adolescence has lengthened. We don't necessarily know why that is. There's a lot of studies out there. But it's continued to ask the question of, when do we become an adult? So even on some of these things, on an aspirin bottle, you become an adult, you take an adult dosage at age 12. For a DMV, you're considered an adult at age 16. For alcohol, being able to drink alcohol, it's 21, culturally. For a movie theater, to get into certain rated movies, it's 13 or 17. To vote, it's 18. To rent a car, it's 25. To stay at an inn or a hotel by yourself is 16. To serve in the military, it's 18. And then to fly as an adult, it's 2. So at 2 years old, you're on a plane, you're considered an adult. All right, so there's also, that's where, no wonder there's this confusion of, at what point am I an adult? Because even just culturally, there's all these different ages that are being thrown at us. So then within that, the stage of adolescence, there's early stages of adolescence, mid, and then late. And so early stages, when you have puberty, mid, as you're processing through it, continuing to grow through it, and then late, when you're starting to stabilize, but then also grow to maturity. And so if the goal of adolescence, the goal of moving from a kid to an adult, that process, the key part in that is for individuation, to recognize who am I, who do I want to be as an adult that's separate from my family. Now the key part of this is I tell staff, this doesn't mean that you need to completely distance yourself from your family. But it's more recognizing, okay, this is a family that I grew up in, this is who I am, but is this the person that I want to become? Is this how I want to have a family? Is this the decisions that I want to make? It's taking responsibility for yourself as an adult, and rather than relying on your parents to take care of you. The process for that, there's really three main questions that students in junior high, high school, and then in young adult are asking. And we program our themes for any of our youth programs around these three questions and what does the Bible say in answering these questions for us. But outside of here, students are still asking these questions. It's questions of identity, autonomy, and affinity. And so the questions of identity of who am I, who do I want to be in this life, affinity, who do I want to belong to? What group? What things do I enjoy doing? What group do I want to be part of? What do I want to belong to? And then autonomy, what makes me unique? What do I uniquely have to offer to the world? And so for junior high, high school, and young adults, they're processing through these questions, and that's a process of individuation, of who do you want to be? I've recently done some studying of recognizing that question of identity, I think that's a lifelong journey, that's a lifelong question, and especially as believers, of who are we as believers in Jesus. And so that's been something that I've pulled out. It's not just adolescent development, but I think human development, of how are we processing our identity. And so for many of our programs here at camp, we're then looking at, okay, students are already asking these questions. Let's point them to the gospel and point them to the Bible and say, what does God say about these things? How do you answer this question of who am I in light of the Bible, in light of what Jesus says in his word? And so some of those examples would be, one summer we did a theme called Upside Down, and it was based in Philippians 3, verses 20 and 21, where it says, you are citizens of another kingdom, and we eagerly await a savior from there. And so we were teaching students to live like you belong to another world. And so this question of, like, who do I belong to? If you believe in Jesus, you are a citizen of that kingdom. You're part of his world and his kingdom here on earth. Live like you belong to another world. Just one of many examples of how we use these questions to point students to the gospel. Oftentimes when I am training the staff, there's a lot of like nodding heads because it's like, yeah, we get this as young adults. And we just recently were going through the process of junior high and high school. But I often will remind them or ask them to remember how they felt when they were in junior high or in high school. Because most of the times the adjectives they use to describe that is scared, insecure, confused, uncertain, anxious. As they experience their bodies changing and then their world changing and recognizing that they're wanting to take responsibility for themselves, but they're not sure how, there's a lot of fear involved in that. And I remember as a kid, it's the process of no longer being able to be at the kids' table and trying to figure out how do I become an adult, and especially in a murky world. One of the things that has really just like clicked in my head is that in these stages of adolescence as we go to adulthood, puberty that leads to adulthood is the second most traumatic experience that our body will go through in like a natural cycle. The first one is birth. Someone being born to the age of 2, there is constant and very rapid growth from being able to support your neck, to then being able to crawl, to then being able, like learning how to walk. It's a very rapid growth in a very short amount of time. And then our bodies go through the second most traumatic growth and rapid change naturally in puberty. And all of a sudden, everything shifts and you kind of have to learn how to walk again because you're now taller than you were. Your voice changes. There's a lot of different changes too. You have to experience a world and the world is potentially the same, but you yourself have changed in it. And so there's these points that mirror each other. And so for 0 to 2 year olds, they go through this sampling phase where they are putting everything in their mouth, they're touching everything, they're experiencing the world through a lot of their senses, and they're sampling it all. Then 3 to 7, they move to the testing phase. A 3 to 7 year old wants to know why to everything. I was watching a TV show with my niece when she was around that age, about 4. We were watching the show Once Upon a Time, and she just was sitting next to me, and she's like, why is the princess doing that? Why is she wearing her hair like that? Why did the dwarf say that? Why is the witch saying that? What's going to happen next? And I was like, dude, Kimball, just chill. If you watch, you'll figure it out. But she was just curious. She just wanted to know why to everything. And then an 8 to a 10 year old, I think 8 to 10 year olds are some of the most confident people on the planet. All right? Yeah, a lot of nodding. They know how the world works. They know who their friends are. I'm going to be the president of the United States, or I'm going to be an astronaut. They know how the world works. And then all of a sudden, puberty hits, or they go to junior high, and everything kind of goes back to the beginning. Junior highers are then in the sampling phase. They are needing to experience the world. They are relearning how to walk based on their height and as their growth. They're sampling a lot. They're trying to figure out how the world works in these new bodies that they're not used to and are feeling a little out of control with. There was at one point during a junior high week at Ponderosa, I was talking to a staff member, and it was this junior higher who just like came out of the dining hall, was looking around, and then just like burst through us and was like looking for something. And they were just kind of, their arms were kind of like waving, and they were just looking for either their counselor or somebody, and everything was fine. But we just kind of laughed at, there's just no social awareness. And they just came bursting through. It's like they didn't know that like that gap was no longer small enough for them to fit through because they're a little bit bigger now, like taller-wise, and their arms are a little bit bigger. And I love junior hires. And I tell the staff, I'm like, we protect our junior hires. We protect them. We don't want to laugh at them. We want to empathize and to normalize and say what you're going through, all of us have gone through. We've all gone through puberty. We all know how that feels. So in the sampling phase, there was another time a student, also at Ponderosa, decided to eat a poisonous plant. And my previous boss, Charlie, was on the phone with UC Med Center trying to like figure out and identify what this plant was and how to like take care of this student. And he was having a very bad reaction to it. And so he sat with him. He was like, why did you decide to eat this plant? Are you hungry? Are you not getting enough food here? Or what's going on? And the student was like, seemed like a good idea. And so there, and that's one of my favorite examples of giving of the sampling. Like, I don't know what this is, but I'll try it. They're just sampling the world, trying to figure out. So we don't treat our junior hires like they're 0 to 2 year olds, but similarly, they're trying to sample the world in newness. So then after sampling comes testing. A high school student, they're testing. They're trying to figure out, again, how the world works, but asking a lot of why. And so a lot of high school students in kind of challenging the parents, asking why to questions, it's similar to a 3 to a 7 year old. Not that they're not mature, but more of they're trying to figure out how the world works, and so they're asking a lot of why, and they're testing the limits. Most of the time, high school students are also testing, are you true to who you say you are? Are you gonna love me even when I'm being a total jerk to you? They're testing. I see that a lot with students here at camp when they're here for just a week. Okay, you say that God loves me. You say that you're going to love me this week. Prove it when I do this. They're testing. And they're asking why. And then the concluding phase, I know how the world works. That comes in college, when they go away to college, and then continued process of that. They're asking a lot of the why questions, but in starting to make some decisions. This is who I want to be. This is how I think the world works. This is the ways that I want to make these decisions. What I say to the young adult staff that I work with, I say, some of the most difficult conversations I've had, the ones that have been the most frustrating, have been with some of the summer staff over the years. Because there will be times when they've been in college for a couple years, and they'll say to me, well, I know what this process is. I know who I want to be. I know how the world works because I'm a communications major, and I know that this is something I'm really good at, and I don't know what's going on with you, but I know they're very confident, very, I took a class on this, and so I know all about it. You can talk to me more if you want to learn more. And there have been times that in my flesh and in my mind, I'm like, oh, this is so frustrating. And there are some times that I'll just say, you know what? Recognizing that they're making some conclusions, that is necessary to affirm that. You're making some conclusions about who you want to be and how the world works, and that is great. But here's the thing, remain teachable. You will never fully arrive, you will never have it fully figured out, and a key part of growing as an adult is to remain teachable. And so I encourage the summer staff, as I sit with them, saying, make conclusions, but also be teachable and don't lose that. As a key part. And so we take all this into account when we are programming for junior high, high school, and then for the young adults, because junior highers are often asking, what are we doing next? They want to know, relationships are based on the activity. A lot of meaning is based on that and the concrete event. They have concrete thinking rather than abstract thinking. And so we do a lot of our programming centered around, like, what are we doing next? And about these different activities and events that they're going to be at. For high schoolers, meaning is developed through relationships. They're asking the question, who's going to be there? And so we program around them having some time, some space, to be able to get to know each other and to build relationships with each other. For then young adults, they're asking why and how does this all fit together? What's the purpose behind this? They want to have significance. They want to have a purpose. And so they're asking a lot of questions of why are we doing this, not necessarily in a testing way, but because they want to understand how the world works, and they want to be part of something purposeful and significant. I think for young adults, they're in a space where they've been encouraged to grow up, but then also have been kind of pushed aside of, but you're not yet an adult. You're not old enough just yet. And so I think there's a lot of young adults who are wanting to know what their place in life and to say, I have these things to offer, and they're not really sure how to best do that. I think one of the, there's been a couple of things that I trained over the year with the interns. The interns who are, most of the time they've graduated from college and they're in like the year or two after college. And they're starting to kind of figure out, okay, I have this degree now, this very expensive piece of paper that says I'm good at something. How do I use that? And we go through a pretty lengthy year in a curriculum with them of looking first at who is God, who has he made us to be, what is our identity in him, recognizing what is this false identity that you've been carrying around for a while, how do you shed that, how do you live into your true identity, and how do you offer that to the world? We go through that process for 9 months with them. One of the books that we read is this book called Defining Decade. I have heard that Meg J., the author, is a Christian, but she doesn't necessarily write this as a Christian book. And so this is more a lot of facts about how to use your 20s well to set you up for the future. It's one that I'm going to kind of flip through again to see if the bookstore is going to carry or not. It's a great book. It doesn't give this... it doesn't end with, here's all the things that you should do. It's more of, here's some information. Think about it. Now you decide what you want to do. It focuses on work, on love and relationships, and then the brain and the body, and how in our 20s, there's still development that's happening within our brains and our bodies, and how to account for that. With love, how to recognize that you can't choose the family that you were born into, but you can choose your family in the one that you want to start, if that's something that you want to do. And then with work, recognizing that many young adults are currently wanting to just make money, which isn't a bad thing, and expecting that their dream job is just going to walk through the doors and land in their lap, rather than recognizing that taking an unpaid internship could then be some of the steps that you need to then grow to having your dream job. And so she kind of points some of those things out of, what are you currently doing in your 20s to set yourself up for the life that you want to have, rather than saying, oh, I'll deal with that later. I'll deal with that in my 30s. And how for many young adults, they're in the season of limbo, thinking, I'll figure that out later, rather than taking the steps that they need to right now. Another book that I read with some of the staff is by Patrick Lencioni. It's called The Ideal Team Player. And it's a model of the characteristics that I look for when I hire people. And so for one, especially working at camp, that they love Jesus, first and foremost. If they have a desire to work with students, especially junior high and high schoolers, that's great. But then I look for these three things that make for a team good team players. And it's that they are humble, that they're hungry, and that they're people smart. And we look for some of those characteristics because it's those characteristics that I look for as the hard skills. If you have it, if you don't have it, those are some of the hard skills. It takes a lot of time to develop humility and initiative, hunger, and emotional intelligence or people smartness. Any of the other skills of how to communicate, how to cast vision, how to lead, oftentimes those can be trained along the way and coached. But some of those traits, those three traits, are what we look for in hiring our summer staff. And then the other book that I've read, it's a leadership book, and it's written by two Navy SEALs. It's called Extreme Ownership. It's one of the best books about leadership that I've read in a while. But I'm also really mindful, my brother's in the military, and I'm really mindful that everyone has different views on the military, the war in Afghanistan. So he uses his experience as a Navy SEAL over in Iraq and Afghanistan as part of his leadership principles. So if you are interested in reading the book, it's a great one, but just know that that's a part of it. It's not a book about war, it's not a book about the military, but he uses his own experience to point to some of those examples. But the thing that I learned about it, not just in leadership, but I think it's the missing link in what we've now termed adulthood or adulting, and how do I do this adulting thing today? I hear that often from summer staff. I'm just having a hard time adulting today. What does that mean? Like, you're having a hard time being an adult? Okay, let's figure that part out. But it's a common phrase. It's kind of, I just kind of laugh at it. And there have been times that I've used it myself of like, yeah, this whole adulting thing is a little hard. But it's this process of ownership. And what it is how to take responsibility for everything within your charge, within your life. You're leading a group of people, taking responsibility for everything that's in your charge. But I think it's a piece that we don't often talk about when it comes to being a young adult and growing to adulthood, is this process of ownership and taking ownership and saying, I'm an individual. My decisions impact me and impact those around me. How do I want to take ownership for my life, for my work, for my career, for my friendships, rather than taking a passive approach, thinking at some point it'll just work itself out? So it's been a great book that I think goes way beyond just leadership and more like lifestyle. And I think it's that one trait of ownership that's missing when we talk to students about how to be an adult. It's this process of ownership. Something that was really interesting was a number of years ago and having these different conversations with my parents and realizing that I will always be my parents' child. I will always be a child to them, but I'm no longer a child. And so I had this one conversation with my mom, and I've been living on my own since I graduated from college and had either roommates or was just living outside of my parents' house after college. And so I go home and I visit them often. I have a very strong relationship with my parents. I'm very grateful for that. And I go home to visit them often. They live about 3 hours east. Because it's also time for me just to be away and to kind of decompress with them. And they offer a lot of wisdom in my life. And so there was one weekend that I was at my parents' house, and there was something that had come in the mail. It had something to do with like a DMV, something that I needed to take care of. And my mom kept reminding me about it. And I was home for a longer amount of time than I normally am. And so she kept being, very respectfully, like, hey, Kelsey, if there's anything I can do to help with this, if you want me to make the call, but just, you know, if you miss it, then it's going to be a fine, and just I don't want you to have to pay that money. And I started to get more and more frustrated. And it was, I finally had a conversation with her rather than just being frustrated and being like, my parents. Instead, I was like, okay, I need to be an adult. I need to take some ownership. I need to have a good conversation with my mom of why am I feeling frustrated. And so had a conversation with her. I'm like, Mom, thank you for what you're doing, what you're trying to help me with. I'm an adult. I need to figure out how to do these things on my own. And if there's a fine for it, then I need to pay that fine to maybe help me learn the next time to be earlier on some of these things. And I said, I don't live here anymore. So what do you think I do when I go back to Santa Cruz? Like, I can take care of myself. And yeah, maybe I'm not showing that in this example of like not paying something in time. But this, please let me do this on my own. Please, I know you're trying to help, but please let me be an adult and let me do this on my own. And my mom is wonderful. She received that and said, okay, Kels, you're right, you're an adult. But then she said this piece, and it really stuck with me. And she said, I wonder how you'll feel when you're a mom one day. And so she said that very respectfully, but it was like, oof. You're right, Mom. I don't know what it's like to be you. I don't know what it's like to be a parent to a child who you once did take care of, and now you're having to, in some ways, let go and watch them flounder at times, trying to take care of themselves. And it was really good perspective for me to have. It was good for me to voice that to my mom, but it was also really good for me to stay teachable and to realize I don't know what it's like to be a parent. And at one point, I think I am going to be eating those words, saying like, oh, yeah, my mom is right in that way. The other thing that my parents, over the last few years, there was a number of years ago, there was some family shifting in our family with some of our extended family. And there were some really hard things that I was processing. I was seeing a counselor at the time, just for some personal choices, and was around the same time that our family and our extended family were going through a lot. And so my parents were going to have my uncle live with them. And so we were cleaning out like one of our childhood rooms, my sibling and I, to then make room to moving stuff around and having our uncle come live with them. And in the things that I was processing with the counselor and with my family, I was not wanting our uncle to come live at the house. I was really upset about it. But it was also this shifting of, you know, our childhood rooms and the family changing, and there's just a lot of dynamics in play. And so I remember knowing, it was weighing really heavily, I'm like, I know I need to talk to my parents about this. And it was probably one of the first, like, very real conversations that I was able to have with my parents, like, adult to adult, while also remembering, I'm still your child, and you're my parent, though we're now adults talking about how our family is shifting, rather than years ago when I would have been a kid, and you probably wouldn't have been talking to some of us about all the ins and outs of what's going on. And so I remember being afraid. This is uncharted territory for me with my parents. Are they going to respect me as an adult? But then I also remember how they took it, and I started to talk to my mom, and my mom's like, Kels, these are some great thoughts. Gary, why don't you come in the room too? And so the three of us sat. I was very emotional. Some of it was because I was scared. I was like, how do I talk about these things with my parents as a young adult? And so in talking about it with my parents and being able to share with them, I felt like I had finally graduated from the kid table. And I was able to sit with my parents, adult to adult, and say, I'm still part of this family, and all of my siblings are too. The decisions you make we're in a boat together. And so the decisions you make, I don't like these decisions, but I'm part of this family, and so I'm going to be affected by it. And I remember realizing that there was so much more going on, so much more history in both of their families, that as a kid, I never had really seen those dynamics play out. And so it was really interesting to finally learn from my parents, hey, remember when you were little and some of these things were going on? They, as adults, had stayed adults with my aunts and my uncles and grandparents. It was things that were familiar to them and things that they had already been processing through. And so for them to stop and realize, okay, now we have no longer children, but adults who are sitting here with us, bringing them into the conversation and being honest with us, and rather than trying to shelter us from the things that they didn't want us to know when we were kids. And so I think for all my cousins, I'm really close with a lot of my cousins as well, all of us and my siblings, it's like a family knows how to do a dance. Everyone knows how to do a dance. They know the routine, who plays what part, and you know the steps to your family routine. And then when one person starts to want to do something different, or especially as adolescence moves to young adulthood to then adulthood, the routine changes because now there's a different person that's in that dance with them. And so it requires kind of everyone relearning the dance together and being able to make space for each other. I've seen that a lot with my younger sister. She's the baby of the family. And so she would often, my older sister, myself, my brother, you know, we're the older siblings, we'd be making the decisions. And it took a lot for her to finally step up and be like, no, I'm a person, I have my own thoughts and I have my own opinions, and stop speaking for me. Just let me, she had a thing as a kid, she called it, don't hoach me, which means don't hold me and don't touch me. Don't hoach me. And then as an adult, she kind of carried that with her of like, no, I'm not the passive baby that's just being carted around to every single soccer game. I'm an adult and I have thoughts and I have opinions. And for all of us, kind of stopped and we're like, yeah, all right, we need to relearn this dance with each other because there's someone new that's entering it. And she has her gifts and her talents and things that she wants to offer as well. So it's making space. And so I know I've talked for a lot and I've probably just thrown a lot of information out, and I would love to give time for some questions. But I think the thing as a young adult who has been in the process of growing to adulthood, I think one of the best things that I did was to, rather than just be frustrated at either my parents, frustrated at the way things were in life, I didn't make excuses for, well, I'm just a young adult. I took some ownership. What can I do? And I also talked with my parents and let them know how I was feeling. All of us have different relationships with our parents. And so at least rather than just giving into frustration of letting them know why I felt frustrated, asking for them to give me the benefit of the doubt when needed, and not letting any frustration or separation distance myself from them. I don't know what it's like to be a parent, but from what I've seen and what my mom has said, she often refers to kids as your heart just walking around outside your body. All right. And so something that my parents did that I was really grateful for was that they made space for us to grow into adulthood. And they didn't force us along, but they also, you know, helped push us along as needed. At one point when I was starting the internship here many years ago, I went home for one weekend and my mom was like, all right, we're going to go around and we're going to put your your AAA insurance and your phone bill, we're going to go to all these places and we're going to put it in your name so that you can start paying for it. So we did a whole bunch of errands, and then they set up, you're now making some money, so you're going to start paying for these things. So they pushed us along when needed, but they always, always let my siblings and I know if you ever need just a place, a safe harbor to come home to and to let down an anchor and just to rest for a moment before you go back to the stormy seas of life, our home can be that place. And so my parents created the space for us, but they also encouraged us to become the adults that we wanted to be, and encouraged us as that was a different faith journey for all my siblings and I as well. All of us grew up in the same home, but all of us have had very different faith journeys along the way. And so my parents have met myself and my siblings in where we're currently at, and encouraging, guiding us, rather than expecting all of us to be in the same place at the same time. So that's what I would have to offer from what I've seen in my parents as well. I know we have lunch coming up. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. You commented briefly about influence of high schools, a little bit about a lot of families.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, just if you could comment briefly about what you're seeing for kids who are coming here,
mm-hmm.
and the influence of youth
Yeah.
Our kids, as we think about, as they go to junior high, we're thinking about church and the context of where they can grow and find disciples and so forth. But there's a lot of signals that we're seeing about youth groups being positive, negative, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, what's interesting, and I just learned this a couple of days ago, that within the top 10 most unchurched areas in the U.S., the Bay Area is one of them, but it's actually gone down in the numbers. It's now number 8 as opposed to being higher in that list. And so my perspective is definitely more toward the Bay Area and Santa Cruz. I think I love seeing youth groups come to camp, and I really encourage them too, and we partner really well with them. But then I also tell students while they're here, if they're not already connected to a youth group, that we want to help do that for them. We kind of play matchmaker with them of, we know these different churches in the Bay Area, tell us where you live, and I can let you know of a couple churches that we partner with, or I know the youth pastor, and be able to connect them with those churches. Because I think there are so many people that are needed for one student to take steps closer to Jesus. There needs to be a lot of people to be able to pour into the students' lives. And so I love when they come to camp, but when we send them home, we want them to stay connected to God's word and God's people. And so we often will ask them, who are some people at home that you can connect with as well? I think what's interesting within Santa Cruz, and that's where I volunteer in a youth group right down the road, what's really interesting about the Santa Cruz students, they will come to church, or they'll come to youth group by the influence of their friends. And there's only a handful of those same students on a Wednesday night whose parents also attend the church. Many of them, it's just word of mouth, and they will invite their friends who have all different types of backgrounds and religious thoughts. They'll bring them to youth group, but they won't come on Sunday. And so there's something, I think, about youth group being a little bit of a safer place in some ways for students who are seeking or are not really sure what they believe, if the youth pastor is making a space for them as well. What's really interesting about currently, at least in Santa Cruz is very spiritual, but very anti-religion. And so a lot of the students who will come to that specific youth group, they are very open and like, sure, this works for you. You can tell me about Jesus. Sure, that sounds great, but there's no reason for me to believe it because I have this over here that I believe in and it works just fine. And so that's a really interesting kind of world that we sit in with Santa Cruz students. The huge drug culture, huge everything that happens on social media, suicide rates, everything is the same here as I'm sure it is in the Bay Area too. But I love seeing students who will come to youth group because it's a safe place where they feel that they can be themselves. And then we just tell them about Jesus every single week. And they'll say, like, yeah, I don't believe that. But they keep coming back. And so I love when they do come back to it. So we try to best serve the students of if they're at a youth group, to encourage them to continue being there. If they're not at one, to try to connect them to one. And then there are some students who will just come to camp. And we really hope that as they're here, they hear the gospel as well. So, yeah, you bet. Any other questions? Yeah. Oh, yes. The one about ownership. Yeah, it was Extreme Ownership. And it's by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. Yeah, it's an excellent book. Yeah.
Anything positive about social media or anything? Kids to participate at all in that? Because I don't understand.
That's a good question. You know what's interesting is that I think there's one part of especially the younger generation as well as millennials, they are very socially conscious and they have a view of the world because of, I think, the internet and social media where they know what's going on in the rest of the world and the global impact. And so there's a huge influence and passion for making the world a better place. And I feel like that is something that millennials as well as Gen Zers have, where it's like, if we can capitalize on that and especially point to the gospel in that, they're a fiery force. that are very passionate individuals. And so I think social media, if there's a positive to it, I think it's the interconnectedness, being able to keep in contact with a lot of people, to know what's going on in their friends' lives. There's obviously the pros and the cons to that. But I think it's also then, it shapes their global awareness as well. And they then become very passionate about what they see going on the other side of the world and what can I do here to help impact in a positive way somebody else. I see a lot of nodding from you guys. So I think it's the interconnectedness and that what I do impacts others. That's a huge positive thing that social media can offer. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they have that network. But when they make these devastating individual decisions, is this as a result of some kind of a frustration? Or like, what do you see kind of, how does that happen? How do you have somebody who seems like they're well supported, their family, well supported,
right,
their community, et cetera, and they make a devastating individual decision?
Right.
You know, any clues?
Like flip it, maybe?
No. I mean, like a suicide.
Yeah, I think it kind of ties into the, you'll be standing in a room full of people and feel so alone. I think there might be, I think it's that. We feel it, you know, physically, but I think social media can give us that same feeling of everyone knows a piece of my life, but they don't really know what's going on internally. And so I think they might, they have a really interesting perspective of what it means to be a friend as well. Yes, exactly. It's the, they want to be known. We all want to be known. And their concept of what it means to be connected to another person is also very different. And so they might be externally connected to a lot of people on social media, but internally feel no connection to them. And so I think it's in the cry for help, in the... I could go on a rampage to talk about the show 13 Reasons Why. I think it's atrocious and awful, and they missed a huge opportunity to actually reach students who are hurting. And they missed being able to use that story to then point students, if you feel this way, this is what you can do. And I think they missed it. And so in the most twisted and evil way, suicide is now being glorified and wanting to be a celebrity. It's just awful. And so I think it's not just the cry for help, but also in this sense of wanting people to finally know. And even if it's after you're gone, people will finally know. Yeah, it's, so I think for, I think one of the best things that we, that a lot of youth workers will do, will talk openly about the effects of suicide on the other people in the room, and like that are connected to the individual, as well as to make known the anonymous hotlines that are always available. We'll have people who will say, well, I'm not struggling with it, but I know someone who is. But they told me to keep it a secret. What do I do? Like, how to coach the students who are carrying these very heavy burdens for each other to make it known to people who can get them the help that they need. So I don't know if that kind of went on the rabbit trail talking about 13 Reasons Why. But yeah, I think it's that sense of feeling very alone, yet knowing that they're connected, but actually not. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
We don't have high schoolers yet, but we work in high school ministry.
Oh, cool.
and our church is kind of going through a Sunday sermon with our youth. And and I struggle a little bit with, like, we want to dive deeper in more applicable topics.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would be some of the main things that you, or resources or something that you could, main topics that you see kids are really wanting to work through in a youth group?
Wow, that's a great question. We did a panel at the youth group, and that was really helpful to then be able to hear what questions they had. And we were only able to answer a few, given the time frame that we had. But then we also had this stack of questions that they had asked anonymously and kind of wrote them on a piece of paper. And so we went through and read them, myself and all the other volunteers, realizing this is what, like, this is what their life looks like. These are the questions that they have. There were a lot of, they wanted to talk about drugs, and is it really wrong when it's no longer illegal? They wanted to talk about sex. They wanted to talk about like friendship dynamics of this friend hates me for this reason, and I kind of hate myself for the same reason. What can I do in making things right with them? Lots of questions about how do I talk to my parents about this topic? My parents want this for me, but I don't want it. Do I have to do what my parents tell me? and what career I want? A lot of questions about college. It's a lot of just like some of the practical life skills of like, how do I work through these conflicts and these different relationships? And then because of that audience of students who don't all believe in Jesus, we then just weave in talking about the gospel to any of those topics and kind of pointing it back to Jesus. So it's a lot of the day-to-day, how do I live as a teenager in this world? Yeah. Well, I'll leave with one. I'll just stay back, so if there's anything that you'd like to talk to me before heading up to lunch. But I hear from people often, I have many different stories in working with junior hires and high schoolers and young adults. But many times I will hear other people say, like, gosh, where are, like, the next generation is just the pits. Millennials are really hard to work with. The Gen Zers just seem so glued to their phones. We just don't understand what is the church going to look like in the next 20 years as the Gen Zers are growing and as the millennials grow into leadership in those churches. What is it going to look like? And I have a limited perspective because I only see the things that play out here or in Santa Cruz. But I often will tell parents or others who are youth workers, man, I wish you could stand in the back of Forest View while the Conference Center Youth students are worshiping Jesus. I wish you could come to a staff worship that we have on Sundays before the week starts, where Redwood and Conference Center and Ponderosa, all the summer staff, all 250, gather for a time of worship before getting ready for a week of camp. I wish you could see the roar in the Pondy Forum as students are worshiping Jesus or cheering for a friend who gives their life to Jesus. Like, man, there are the young adults and the students who are going to become young adults in just a few years. There is a handful of them who passionately love Jesus, and they may be few, but man, they are fierce. And so there is great hope with the current Gen Z generation as well as millennials, and God is going to do incredible things, and he is at work in this place and elsewhere in shaping them and using them for his glory. So, yeah, thank you.